From the nation's capital, this is DC Public Safety. I'm your host, Leonard Sipes. Understanding crime in America is our topic today, ladies and gentlemen. Nobody better to explain crime in America than John Roman. He is a senior fellow with the Urban Institute Justice Policy Center, www.urban.org. You can follow John on Twitter at John K. Roman. John, welcome back to DC Public Safety.
Thank you very much, sir.
There is nobody better to explain the topic of crime in America than you, because it gets really difficult to understand, because for the last 20 years, there's been an almost continual decrease in crime in the United States. It has been almost continuous with a couple blips here and there. Yet at the same time, we have the Gallup organization coming out with a poll suggesting that most Americans believe that crime is increasing. We have, again, another Gallup poll talking about household victimization, that if you included cybercrime, this is on a one-year basis, criminal victimization, household victimization is up to 46%. If you take a look at Ferguson, if you take a look at other issues of importance, if you take a look at what's happening in cities throughout the United States where crime is a problem, if you say that crime has gone down continuously for the last 20 years, they give you a blank stare. Can you place all of this into context for us?
Sure. So I think what happens is throughout most of the middle of the last century, crime was pretty stable in America, for a bunch of reasons that we could talk about. But in the 60s, crime, and particularly violence, and particularly crime around drug use and drug distribution, starts to really skyrocket, and skyrockets throughout the 70s. It stays very high throughout the 80s. It declines in the 90s, sort of stabilizes. And then the last 5 or 6 years, it's declined again. Only the decline in the 90s sort of happened everywhere. The decline in the last 5 or 6 years has really been focused in particular geographies and not everywhere. And so people's experiences with the crime decline has been very different of late.
Explain the geographies.
Sure. So what you see is places like New York City and Washington and Dallas and San Diego are places that have experienced a second really large decline in violence. Mm-hmm. Places like Chicago and Philly and Pittsburgh and other, Rust Belt cities have seen much less of a decline in violence. And even in some of these cities, Baltimore, you see, even little upticks in violence at the mm-hmm. same period.
So, but how do you put all that in perspective? I mean, if you tell the average person that crime has had an almost continual 20-year decline, there have been little ticks where it's gone up here and there, but over the last 20 years plus, crime has gone down. Yet the average person out there, according to Gallup, feels that crime is going up. Did a radio show yesterday about crime coverage in America where the Pew study from 2011 was cited, saying that crime is one of the most popular topics that people want in terms of their news coverage. I think sports and weather were the only topics that beat it. Mm-hmm. So people are really concerned about crime. Again, you tell them 20-year decline in crime, and they look at you like you've got three heads, especially if they're from Baltimore or Detroit or from Chicago.
Right. So I think the story is violence in America, according to the FBI, has declined 20 of the last 23 years. Mm-hmm. As I said, it declined everywhere in the 90s, sort of stabilized, and now it's sort of more focused in specific places are having better experiences with crime. All that said, the national narrative is one about a violent America being dominated by violent criminals. And, you can go on to cable TV and easily find a show like Gangland that shows pictures of really violent groups of dangerous, heavily armed people distributing drugs and attacking strangers. Mm-hmm. If you're careful on how you look at these shows, you'll note that most of them are showing footage from the late 80s and early 90s, and almost none of them are showing footage that has occurred in the last generation. Mm-hmm. But the message still penetrates. The message still is, anytime there's a violent incident in America, anytime there's a kidnapping, anytime there's a shooting incident with multiple victims, that's the news that dominates everywhere and everybody. And so it almost doesn't matter what's happening in your neighborhood. Mm-hmm. The narrative is America's violent, you need to be scared.
Well, America's violent, you need to be scared, but it's wrong because, again, crime has been down for the last 20 years. But Americans watch our television shows. You and I had the discussion before we hit the record button of where I can't stand to watch the crime shows because you have very young, very good-looking people with the best possible equipment with all the time in the world solving crimes almost instantaneously through technology. That doesn't exist. exist. It's a myth. I think people are being pulled in a lot of different directions in terms of what it is that they should believe. There is something called the CSI effect in courtrooms where they're actually losing court cases because the jury comes in with an expectation that what they see on television is what is real. So the point is that what is real? How should Americans see crime, and how do Americans place it within its proper context? And then the follow-up question is going to be the hardest question of all. Question that I get from time to time from news media is, why is crime down over the course of the last 20 years?
So if you're over the age of 40, you've never lived in a safer America than you do today. And that is true virtually everywhere in America. The popular TV narrative about the criminal mastermind, the hacker, the serial killer, those people don't really exist. What causes crime in America is dense communities of low-skilled young men. And we've gotten better as a society about policing those communities, and we've gotten better about how we change what the makeup of public housing is. And frankly, we've taken a lot of those young men and we've put them under the thumb of the correctional system, and they're less able to commit crime. So we've been effective across a number of different domains in reducing crime in America. That message has not gotten out. You know, there's a saying on Capitol Hill that efficiency has no constituency. So the idea that we've become more efficient and more effective isn't a message that anybody is out there beating the drum about, because, you know, there's nobody who's going to really be responsive to it.
Efficiency has no constituency. That's an interesting thought.
Right. So
a very interesting thought.
So anybody who wants to tell the story that the world is getting better doesn't really have anybody to tell it to. If you want to tell the story about the world being worse and being dangerous and you should, you know, arm yourself and buy a home security system. I think one of the things that's undersold in all of this is corporate America. If you look at these ads about home security systems, they're really appalling at what at the messages. You know, young mom at home with her young daughter and a guy breaking in through the window. I mean, it's absolutely frightening. But those sorts of things don't actually happen very often, and they happen less and less frequently over time. But the messaging has gotten more and more vivid and more scary, and I think that causes Americans to be more and more afraid.
But we never have lived in a safer America, which is perfectly true. Now, there are two surveys. I mean, there are two sources of information. One are crimes reported to law enforcement, and then there's the National Crime Survey, which is reported and unreported crime through survey. Both are basically saying the same thing. I mean, you may find different variations from time to time, but the trend lines certainly are down for both the National Crime Survey and the crimes reported to law enforcement. If you take a look at lots of other indices, such as drug use, such as people in school, younger individuals in school being involved in crime, there are dozens of others. They all seem to be down. So it's just not John's opinion.
That's
correct. This is the bulk of the research, good research, over decades, basically saying the same thing.
So I think that if you said, compared to 1990, is crime down at least 50% in America, particularly violent crime, I think you are on solid ground. I think the FBI data reflects that. I think the victimization surveys reflect that. I think that if you look at any local law enforcement data that happens to go back that far, I think they reflect that. So I think that story is sort of inarguably true. The question is the one that you posed. Why has this happened? And what can we do next to continue the trend?
That's what criminologists want to know. I mean, there was a point where I forget exactly what the year, but the FBI at a certain point said homicides were at their lowest rate in decades.
Since the early 1960s.
That's
and so
amazing.
Homicide's a really good indicator for all of this, because the rest of the kinds of victimization is... So one of the things happening in America is that we're getting older on average, and we're getting wealthier on average. And that means we're more scared. We're more risk-averse. We want there to be even less crime than there is. So reporting about crime might change a little bit as people sort of get older and scareder and richer and have more to protect, and might tend to report things as being crimes that maybe they wouldn't have reported 20 years ago when they were, you know, younger and poorer and less scared. But if you look at the national police reporting data, it's just inarguable that crime is way down in America. And it's interesting. Every year I talk to reporters right around January 1st and we tell this story, and I go to the comment sections of these, you know, big international national newspapers.
Yes.
And there's hundreds, if not thousands, of comments about why I'm absolutely wrong.
Right. Right. And I guess that's the point. Again, when you talk to different people, they look at you like you have three heads when you start citing the data. But it's just not John's opinion. We're talking about, again, not to beat the point to death, but in terms of the survey data, in terms of the crime reported to law enforcement, in terms of lots of other surveys, lots of other indices, it all follows the same trend line. So there's no doubt that you are correct. So the criminological question, the reporter's question, Leonard, can you give me an explanation as to why crime is down over the course of the last 20 years? And my response is, call John Roman.
Well, I appreciate that. I think I would note that the other supporting bit of evidence is that in none of the last national elections has the issue of crime been even addressed in any sense. So if it really was something that we needed to change our policies around, it would have come up, and it didn't. So that's important. So why is crime down? Crime is down for five reasons. Crime is down in the 90s because we quadrupled. We increased 400% the number of people in America who are incarcerated. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean it's a good policy. That doesn't mean it's not incredibly inefficient. It doesn't mean it's not a waste of taxpayer money to incarcerate that many people. But inevitably, if you put enough people behind bars and under supervision, you are going to reduce crime, and that happened. Mm-hmm. At the same time, the crack epidemic in 1990-1991 ends. This is the lowest number of people using crack cocaine in the last three generations is in 1991. People mm-hmm. stopped using it mm-hmm. As those drug markets dried up. There was less violence around them. And mm-hmm. those two explanations explain why crime declined in the 90s.
Okay.
Why is crime declining today? So beginning in about 2007, crime starts to decline again. But like we started, it's not everywhere. It's Washington, New York, Dallas, San Diego. It's not Baltimore, Philadelphia, Chicago.
Okay.
Why is that? There's three reasons for that. And there are all other reasons why people will look at you like you have three heads. Mm-hmm. One reason is that some of these cities became very friendly to immigrants. And on average, according to criminologists that I believe, a community of recent immigrants that's basically poor and living in a dense place will have, on average, a lot less crime associated with that community than the exact same impoverished community of people who've lived here for generations. Mm-hmm. And so what happens is, and you've seen cities like D.C. and New York, you know, you can transact business entirely in Spanish with the governments of these cities. Mm-hmm. And they've really tried to attract immigrants as a new source of labor. Mm-hmm. And what happens is neighborhoods that are really cheap and poor become safer, and then they attract gentrifiers, mm-hmm. people who want to live, they want to own their own home, but they can't afford it, and they don't want to buy in dangerous places. And all of a sudden, these places in Washington, D.C., you see, you know, Adams Morgan and places like that, and this is true in every city, you can find these communities, that all of a sudden become safer and cheap. And so people move in and they buy and they invest. Mm-hmm. And that investment breeds more investment. And over time, that part of the community starts to thrive and it becomes less segregated.
Are we saying that there are market forces taking place that are just as important as the criminological efforts?
I'm saying that almost every explanation for why crime has declined in the last 10 years has pretty much nothing to do with criminal justice policy. I think we've gotten better at policing. I think technology's gotten better. But if you look at the other explanations, I don't know that they have a lot to do with how we spend our public resources. I think, you know, there's a reason why the car that's most often stolen in America was manufactured in 1999. Because mm-hmm. you can take a flathead screwdriver and shove it into the ignition,
yes.
twist it,
yes.
and drive off with it.
Yes.
Try and do that with a car that was manufactured in the last 10
Can't
years.
Do it.
Can't do it. Doesn't
Can't
work. And so that's a big part of the explanation.
And all of that is down. You take a look at all of the areas where you have security devices coming into play, and also the discussion in terms of stolen iPhones, stolen computers, and now we're talking about making sure that they cannot operate when they're stolen. And when that happens, those were also plummet. So there are technological advances, there are economic advances, there are advances in the criminal justice system. Those of us within the criminal justice system will say, well, what we did was to stabilize these communities to the point where they could change economically. So they're going to take credit for that from a law enforcement point of view or from a correctional point of view. So you have all of this plus what?
So I think all of that is exactly right. So I think we've learned a lot about how to do better policing. I think we've learned a lot about how to do better supervision of people in custody, whether it's community corrections or within the criminal justice correctional system itself. I think we've gotten much better about treating the underlying causes of people's criminal offending, whether that's alcohol abuse or drug abuse or mm-hmm. mental health problems or whatever it is that makes people unhappy with their station in life. We've gotten a lot better at trying to address the underlying problem rather than just locking people up. I think the technological, the security improvements, and I think all of these things create a trend that should cause there to be more crime if you just get out of its way.
This is an amazing conversation. Every time I have John Roman, senior fellow from the Urban Institute, by our microphones, I'm always fascinated by the discussion. There are a lot of folks within the criminological community who do wonderful research, but I'm not quite sure they can explain it nearly as well as John. John, again, is with the Urban Institute Justice Policy Center, www.urban.org, www.urban.org. You can follow John at Twitter, at John K. Roman, R-O-M-A-N, at Twitter. We're talking today about understanding the crime a problem in America, putting it in context and explaining it because of the continual 20-year reductions in crime, yet there's an awful lot of people out there who remain very concerned about crime per Pew, per Gallup, and people who are living in cities who are having crime problems. So, John, in those cities that are continuing to have the crime problems, you look at criminal justice news summaries from criminal justice reporters every single day, and you take a look at the Chicagos, you take a look at the Baltimores, and so people there are very concerned. How do you solve their problems? How do they follow the what's happened in Washington, D.C. and in New York and other cities where we have been successful?
So some of it is acknowledging what your weaknesses are, and some of it is acknowledging what your strengths are. So if you look at a map of Chicago compared to a map of New York, and you look at the just the distribution of people where they live by their race, what you'll see when you look at Chicago is an incredibly segregated city.
Mm-hmm.
What you look at when you look at New York is not a perfectly integrated city, but a much more integrated city.
Hmm.
And it's that isolation of people where they're never exposed to anybody who has a different experience than they have, who isn't poor, mm-hmm. who has a job, whose dad isn't incarcerated. In New York, you're much more likely to have those sort of multiple experiences and exposures, and that allows you to have hope, to try and work on making your life better, and in ways that just don't happen in places like the South Side of Chicago, where all experiences in Englewood are bad.
So it's integration and immigration and other market forces, once again, as much as they are criminological efforts.
I think that's right. I mean, I think, it's what we said. So the natural trend of the world is for more safety. Security is getting better. Your ability to secure your property is getting better. Your car, your home, yourself. The police are getting better at investigating and arresting people who are involved in criminal opportunities. There are all kinds of other things going on in the world that make the world safer. I mean, look, if you want to buy drugs today, mm-hmm. You don't have to go to an open-air drug market where you're going to be surrounded with dangerous people, some of whom are drug-seeking, some of whom are selling and are mm-hmm. armed. You mm-hmm. can whip out your cell phone and call somebody, and they'll bring it to you.
Yes.
Right? And so the world is getting safer. The trend is toward more safety. The question is, what can cities do to help accelerate that trend?
Well, what can they do?
One thing they can do is be very friendly to immigrants.
Okay.
And allow these communities to develop of people who can live in a city to help the city grow, bring new resources to it, help accelerate the trend of gentrification, help decelerate the trend of segregation,
mm-hmm.
and create an atmosphere that's more conducive to lower crime and more economic development.
You take a look at the worldwide crime trends, and you and I talked about this on a previous radio show. I remember in an advanced criminology course a long time ago looking at the crime trends for New Zealand, mm-hmm. for Australia, for Great Britain, for Canada, the other Western industrialized countries. Crime seemed to go up.
Mm-hmm.
And seem to come down with the same trend line. Not necessarily the same numbers.
Right.
But the trend lines seem to be there. So not only are we talking about an explanation of crime in America, we're talking about an explanation of crime in the Western industrialized world. If it all basically rises and falls mm-hmm. at the same time, it's just not an explanation within the United States. It's a Western industrialized explanation.
And I think that's exactly right. So there's two things going on there that are really interesting. And one is, do the trend lines in Australia and Great Britain and Canada and the U.S., are they the same mm-hmm. over time? And they are. What's interesting about it is that None of those other countries had the same experiences we had with crack cocaine, mm-hmm. and none of them had the mass incarceration response. Mm-hmm. So if you think that the world is sort of trending together and you want to understand why crime is declining, it does make you want to scratch your head a little bit and wonder why other nations that didn't have the crack cocaine, didn't have mass incarceration, are experiencing the same levels of decline.
Yes.
And there are some explanations for that. One explanation for that is, it's a really simple one, which is that we took lead out of gasoline in the 1970s, and so did most Western industrialized countries. Mm-hmm. People, when they think about lead poisoning, they think about kids eating lead paint, mm-hmm. which I'm up against. Mm-hmm. But it's not really what's dangerous. What was dangerous was leaded gas, that regular gas, mm-hmm. In the 70s that caused people's exposure to lead in their bloodstream to be much higher than it is today. And that sort of lead poisoning, that lead exposure, causes people to behave in more antisocial ways, to be less able to exhibit self-control. And it's postulated that that's part of the explanation. Another part of the explanation is that security technology has gotten better everywhere. Mm-hmm. Another part of the explanation is that we've learned a lot about policing. Police in Australia and Canada and the U.S. and Great Britain all talk to each other. They go to the same conferences. They hear the same researchers.
Yes. The criminological system that lifts all boats.
I think it's right. And you know, the focus has been much more on trying to do things in the community, trying to keep adolescents out of juvenile corrections and in family-based therapies, trying to treat underlying disorders rather than incarcerating people, teaching police how to be part of the community rather than a security force. And I think all of those things have contributed, as you said, to stabilizing communities to allow these other larger forces to accelerate the crime decline.
Now, within the context of all of this, declining crime, but yet, as I said before, the Gallup poll indicating that people are more concerned about crime. The Gallup poll saying that if you add cybercrime, 46% of households on a yearly basis experience crime. Within that context of criminologists and reporters and average people trying to put all of this in its proper context, we have Ferguson and the other issues. We're having a very intense discussion over the role of the police, the role of the community, what is proper, what is just, what we should be doing. It's a conversation, I think, that we within the criminal justice system welcome. But again, it's confusing to people because they're told that the New York City miracle, and I think it is a miracle, was done through very aggressive law enforcement, very, very, very aggressive law enforcement. And that was the issue that held crime down in New York. And that's been exported to crime analysis, crime mapping, very proactive law enforcement. That has been offered as an explanation for why crime has gone down in certain cities. Put that up against the current conversation we're having now about race and law enforcement in America. How do we make sense of all that?
So in 1990 in New York City, there were over 2,200 homicides. I think last year there were under 400. 2,200 to under 400.
It's an unbelievable decline.
There were 110,000 motor vehicles stolen in New York City in 1990. Last year, I believe there were only about 10,000. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that was due to very aggressive policing. Now, contrast that with Washington, D.C., which had 479 homicides that same year, 1990, mm-hmm. which got as low as 88 a couple years ago, mm-hmm. 479 to 88 in a city.
Huge drop.
Just you know,
huge
80 drop. Plus percent, just an enormous. And what Chief Lanier, Kathy Lanier, has done in Washington, D.C. is really focused on community policing. She has all her officers write their cell phone numbers on the back of business mm-hmm. cards, hand them out to people, tell them, call me anytime, day or night. If you think a beef is developing that's going to turn into something serious, you know, call me and I will come.
And in both cities, you can feel this.
And you can
you
feel
can
it.
Feel right. it, touch it, smell right. it, taste yeah. it. But you see, those of us who have been to New York several times, or those of us who work in D.C. or live in D.C., you can feel this.
So, but what's interesting, so let's talk about Ferguson, what Ferguson means in that context of these different policing styles. I think, you know, one of the takeaways from Ferguson that hasn't gotten any attention is that it's a tacit acknowledgement that the way we feel about law enforcement in America has changed. That in 1990 in New York City, when there are over 2,000 7 homicides in a single year, which is just an astonishing number. The sort of tactics that were employed in Ferguson and with Tamir Rice in Cleveland and, you know, Eric Garner and, you know, in Long Island and all these things, you know, would have been a blip on the radar because there was so much violence and we, you know, sort of all accepted that, that we needed to, you know, we needed to get these places stabilized, as you said. I think that's right. And I think today we've gotten to the point where crime has declined, where people don't believe there's as much violence, and they're just they're not as accepting as these kind of police tactics as they would have been 20 years ago.
So it's a new conversation for a new time.
And it's almost in many ways it's almost an optimistic conversation, right? Because the fact that people were willing, you know, it's worth noting that it takes an enormous amount to get people to go out into the streets to put their liberty at risk.
Yes.
Right? In order to make a statement about a policy issue like how the police. So the fact that we've seen these huge gatherings all across America in virtually every city is a sign that people care enormously about this this issue. And the other thing that we've seen is almost virtually every single one of these demonstrations has been nonviolent,
right?
This isn't like the 60s when or the L.A. Compton riots or the riots in D.C.
And people need to understand that context.
Yep.
I mean, we lived through decades where there was a lot of violence associated with demonstrations, and there were endless demonstrations for endless reasons.
Right.
Now, most of these, the great majority of these, are nonviolent demonstrations.
But it goes to your other question, which is the really interesting part. So if I'm sitting there as a criminologist watching these demonstrations and thinking about what it means in terms of policy, my reaction is, this is really hopeful. This really makes me feel good about the world, that people care enough to go out and voice their opinion on this topic, that they're nonviolent, that the police in many places, I mean, Tom Nestel is the chief of the SEPTA police in Philadelphia, and you know he followed the demonstrators and would tweet things like, you know, citizens exercising their rights, right? And that's wonderful.
It's an opportunity for a new conversation, but maybe that new conversation is welcome and necessary.
It is, but the problem is that then you have a lot of the news media is focusing on the few people who are part of those demonstrations who are, you know, breaking into the 7-Eleven or the Wawa and taking cases of water and or have bandanas over their face somehow masking their identities, and because that makes for better television. And so even though this conversation has been, I think, overwhelmingly positive, the news media's portrayal of it has been frightening to a segment of America who is risk averse to begin with.
Well, that's why we're calling the program Understanding Crime in America, because again, people need to have some sense of context. Reporters, citizens need to have, we within the criminal justice system need to have some sort of context in terms of the not just what's happened within the last 2 years, but what's happened in the last 30, 40 years.
That's right. And I think, you know, the big change in America has been our urban policy. So our urban policies in the 50s and 60s were designed to divide. We built big interstate highways that separated and segregated and isolated huge portions of our citizenries. We're beginning to take those things down. We're beginning to build subways that integrate our communities. We're encouraging immigration. We're encouraging gentrification, economic development. We're encouraging all sorts of racial integration that didn't exist before. And all of those forces, those natural forces, along with the technological growth, the growth of security, the maturation and evolution of our policing agencies, all of those things put us on a trend where America in the next generation should be even safer than it is now. And, you know, that those policies could be accelerated if Americans could be convinced that the world is, in fact, a good place today, and they'd be willing to invest in those things.
Final minute of the program, John. We did have a point where 5-6 years ago we were talking about the super predators and the coming increase in crime. That hasn't happened. So how long can we take this decline in crime? How far out?
I mean, I think it can go a long way. I think, you know, there's been a lot of research. So as a researcher, I find that it's rare that research really penetrates. But one bit of research really did. So this was some studies that Larry Steinberg and his colleagues did at Temple University, where they did studies about brain evolution and maturity and social and emotional maturity of young people. And what they concluded was people continue to evolve into their late 20s, and that this threshold of 18-year-olds being adults is really arbitrary. Mm-hmm. And I think criminal and juvenile justice systems have really responded to this message and begun to think about young people differently. And it's really helped us to avoid having this super predator thing happen.
And we have yet a better understanding of crime in America, which is the title of our program. Ladies and gentlemen, we've had John Roman, senior fellow with the Urban Institute Justice Policy Center. Every time we have John before our microphones, we get lots of positive comments in terms of John's ability, wonderful ability to explain very complex issues. www.urban.org at John K. Roman, R-O-M-A-N. If you're interested in following John via Twitter, ladies and gentlemen, this is DC Public Safety. We appreciate your comments. You know, we even appreciate your criticisms, and we want everybody to have themselves a very, very, very pleasant day.